We might as well start this morning's talk now on Tuesday morning, is that right? Isn't it great? I don't know where you are, as far as days are going. Actually, you do know where you are, you're here. Today I wanted to talk, to cover a question which was asked last night about can you explain the use of Buddho as a meditation technique and how to use other meditation techniques as well as Anapanasati meditation on the breath, how to do more on death meditation, and how to give a bit more variety in the meditation we're doing. Because obviously sometimes if you do the same thing again and again, sometimes just the mind rebels because it just gets bored and it wants a bit of variety. And because of that, there are many other different meditation subjects which one can take up. But instead of taking them up instead of the breath and just really completely abandoning the breath, I think it's a good idea to use these as well as the breath, in conjunction with the breath. It's just a part of the whole meditation process of calming the mind, because this whole thing we call meditation is like allowing the mind to become calm, to untie the defilements, sort of overcome the hindrances so you can get clarity of mind. And of course the first thing I want to say is that the old debate about karma and insight or samatha vipassana, as if there were two different types of meditation, that according to myself and my teacher Ajahn Chah, that is not correct. There is no difference between samatha and vipassana. So what you've been doing so far for this whole retreat, you can call it vipassana meditation if you like, and it's absolutely correct. Or you can call it samatha meditation if you like, and it's absolutely correct. Because what you are doing is developing that calm and insight which always go together. Even in the one of the most important suttas which confirms this, was not actually taught by the Buddha, but by Venerable Ananda. And one can, by the content of that particular teaching, place that sutta just after the Buddha passed away, just after his parinibbana. And at that time, Venerable Ananda, being the attendant of the Buddha and being such a well-known and important monk, became, as it were, one of the leading figures. And when monks or nuns would come and ask or tell him about their attainments, he would be the one they'd obviously go to. And he said in this sutta that when monks and nuns come and tell me they've attained arahat, fully enlightened, he said they always come and say they've reached that attainment in one of four ways. Either putting samatha in front and vipassana behind until the path becomes clear, and then making much of that path, the defilements are all abandoned. Or putting vipassana in front and samatha behind. Till the path becomes clear, and making much of that making much of that path, they become fully enlightened. Or taking samatha and vipassana completely together until the path becomes clear, and then making much of that path, they become fully enlightened. Or the fourth way, not mentioning samatha and vipassana at all, but when the defilements, the five hindrances are overcome, the path becomes clear, and make much of that path, and then they become fully enlightened. Those four ways. In the path becomes clear, that is the indication of the stream winning. Seeing the Dhamma, understanding what the Buddha saw, becoming a stream winner, after being a stream winner, making much of that path. In other words, developing that path until all the defilements are completely eradicated. But the first three, which mention samatha vipassana, mention very clearly that you can't just have samatha just alone. You can't just have vipassana alone. You may have one pronounced, one walking in front, but the other one is always walking behind. They're like twins. You can't really separate them. And this is actually the way of things. Whether you think you're practicing vipassana, whatever the technique of meditation you are, it has to depend upon calming the body, calming the mind, developing happiness, developing samadhi, and there, finding your wisdom. There is another sequence which I should really leave until I give that talk, which I'm supposed to give later on, about the seven facts of enlightenment. It's actually a sequence which reoccurs in the Buddha's teachings, actually how enlightenment works. And from the sense of inspiration or joy, we come, this is called a prasada. One gets the sense of piti. So that piti is that delight, a mind which leaps towards the practice, the meditation. And from that piti, we get what's called prasadi. And there's two types of prasadi, the kaya prasadi and the citta prasadi. This is the tranquility, the calmness. Once you incline towards the meditation, then eventually just the body becomes very calm and peaceful. And the body becomes very and the mind becomes very calm and peaceful. From those, the joy, the confidence, comes the piti, comes the inspiration or the leaping towards the joy. From that comes the calmness of the body and the calmness of the mind. From the calmness of the body and the mind comes the happiness, the inner happiness, the contentment, the feeling that this feels so lovely, so wonderful. And from that comes the samadhi, the very peaceful, still states of jhanas. And from that comes wisdom, yathābhūta jñāna-dassana. And from that comes vimutti, freedom. These are the sequence which the Buddha kept on repeating, the sequence of how to gain enlightenment. So there's no sort of one path is samatha, one path is vipassana. It just depends on which sort of side of the coin you're focusing on. So whatever you're doing, there has to be calm, there has to be insight. And the measure of your insight, how much you understand, is how calm you can become. So that's the function of insight. The function of insight is to overcome obstacles, overcome defilements. And you know if it's real insight, if it produces peace and calm. And you know it's calm, you know it's real stillness, if it produces insight. If it truly is calm, if it truly is stillness, then you're seeing very clearly. That's why the measure of insight is how much calm you produce. The measure of calm is how much insight you have. So this is just saying that these two go together, and they always do go together. So in all of the meditation subjects I'm going to talk about this morning, they include samatha, they include vipassana as an unavoidable consequence of doing them. And so you've got something like maranasati, what I was talking about last night, the contemplation, the reflection on death. And some people say, is that samatha meditation, is that vipassana meditation? The answer is it's both. Because if you really do maranasati and do it well, it creates an enormous sense of calm inside. Not fear, but calm. And if you do maranasati, it also gives a lot of insight and wisdom. Now that this body is not going to last very long, it's going to die at any time. And that's an insight which comes up. And why am I afraid of this? The insight comes up because I'm clinging on to this body. I think this body is me and mine. If you realize that this body is just a vehicle, and the mind is like a driver inside this vehicle, then you're not so concerned if this vehicle has a crash. Especially if you've got a good insurance policy. You know what the insurance policy means? The insurance policy in this simile of the body being a vehicle, its insurance policy is karma. If you've done a lot of good karma, you've got a really good insurance policy. So if you crash this car, then they give you a new car. In fact, if you've got a really good insurance policy, if you crash this car, you get an even better car than you got now. But for those of you who haven't done very much good karma and done a lot of bad karma, your insurance premiums haven't been paid up, and you're going to get an old bomb of a car in your next life. So keep your karma premiums well paid up. But the point is, you don't have to be afraid if you know that this body is not yours, it's just it's an abiding, a temporary body. Why are people afraid of death? Are you afraid of death? Sometimes we don't know until it actually happens. There's this old story told by the forest monks. This actually includes one of the questions here about the meditation on Buddha. This monk was wandering around from village to village. He was a two-dog monk, one of the old forest monks. And when he got to a village for one afternoon, sort of he was talking to the villagers, and he got a bit above himself and a bit proud. And he was telling them how he's not afraid of anything. And the villagers say, "Well, aren't you afraid of even like wild animals, like tigers?" He said, "No, tigers, they're nothing." I said, "Really?" They said, "Yeah, yeah." And they said, "Well, look, sort of there's a tiger who's been harassing the village. And we know the tiger passed. And we actually know when tigers actually they leave a smell. They're very strong smelling animals." He said, "Why don't you tonight sort of put your mosquito net right next to the tiger path? And see if you can handle that, see if you're really scared. Prove it." And so the monk said, "Ah, no worries at all, I can do that. Tigers, no trouble at all." So this monk, or the villagers went with him, showed him where the tiger trail was. And he put his mosquito net right next to the tiger trail and started sitting meditation. When the sun went down, very peaceful, and he was just doing the Buddha meditation. Which is when you breathe in, you say to yourself like a mantra, "Buddha, breathe out, ta, bud, ta, bud, ta." It's a very, very peaceful meditation. But then sometime later in the night he was doing bud, ta, bud, ta. He heard a sound of a jungle animal coming across the along the path. Bud, ta, bud, ta. And then it got louder and louder, "Buddha, Buddha, 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 Buddha." And then he opened one eye and he saw this huge tiger. Instead of Buddha, it was tiger, 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 tiger. And before he knew it, he lost his meditation and he was running away from this tiger. Now, many of you have seen like the monk's robes, they're just wrapped around you. And they're not really meant for running. And in fact, if you do try running, you find they fall off very quickly. And this is what happened to this monk. It's actually a true story. It's actually Anjuan, one of the forest monks, told me this. Is that by the time this monk got into the village, shouting, "Tiger, tiger, tiger," waking up all the villagers who looked in to see that he hadn't got a shred of clothing left on him. He was completely naked. And that poor old monk got really embarrassed. As he realized that sort of he was afraid after all. Because sometimes you don't know until it actually happens. You don't know if you're going to be afraid of death until you're right facing it. And that's why one of the great meditations to do on your walking meditation path is the best place to do it. This was one of the meditations which again comes from a Thai forest teacher, but which was adapted by Ajahn Chitamala at the monastery down at Serpentine. When you're walking meditation, when you move your left foot, think to yourself or say to yourself, "I will die." If you move your right foot, that's for sure. "I will die." That's for sure. I will die. That's for sure. Now, if you're getting sleepy and tired, nothing's happening, try that. I will die, that's for sure. It's a great meditation. Because first of all, it gives you something to do. The first thing which happens, you get really sort of scared. You don't want to do that. Why don't you want to do it? "I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure." What happens, one of those wonderful things about the Dhamma, if you keep on doing that, "I will die, that's for sure," you have to contemplate as you go along. Because you're just telling yourself this thing which you have to hear. "I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure." After a very short while, you get so peaceful and calm. "I will die, that's for sure." You go past fear into a sense of letting go. There's a sense of peace. That's what death meditation does. As long as you keep on doing it and get through that fear, it gives a marvelous sense of freedom. Freedom from the fear of death. And it puts everything in perspective. All the worries and concerns and things that you think about when you should be watching the breath become just so meaningless. "I will die. That's for sure. I will die. that's for sure. This is what death meditation does, and that's one beautiful way of doing it. If you really want to do that when you're sitting meditation, it's harder because, you know, it's harder to keep those words going. But if you want to, if you're breathing in, I will die. Breathing out, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And see what happens. make sure you've written out your will first of all before you do anything. With these meditations on death, they're actually incredibly powerful. And sometimes the great forest teachers in our tradition, they used to use these to really sort of get monks going. It's not just you who sometimes have difficulty in meditation. Sometimes monks for years and years have difficulty watching the breath and getting into deep meditation, getting into jhana. One of the great stories was of one of the monks who was always had trouble with sloth and torpor, was always sleepy. And he was a disciple of Ajahn Chah's teacher, Ajahn Mun. And so Ajahn Mun sort of said, come over here. And he took him on a journey through the forest until they came to this clearing. On the edge of the clearing was a cliff. And the cliff was very high. And it was almost sheer. And down the bottom there was all the rocks. And he told him, he said, right, sit down cross-legged on the edge of this cliff. And don't move, I'll come back tomorrow. And such was the obedience and the faith of monks in those days, that if the teacher said it, that's what you had to do. And this poor monk, because he was always nodding, and when you nod, more and more, it's only a matter of time before you fall over the edge. And he thought, when he wrote his biography afterwards, he thought that was it, that night he was going to die for sure. And because of that, putting himself right on the edge of death, and thinking that was his last night, he did, the first time in his monkhood, get into a very nice jhana. And so when he opened his eyes, he didn't sort of know how many minutes had gone past, only hours, but it was dawn. He'd sat all night without falling off. When he opened his eyes and saw it was dawn, the first thing which came into his mind is time for the monks to go on alms round. Time for me to go and get my food. But then he looked at his mind and it was so blissful and so peaceful and pure, he said, that's not what I need. He just closed his eyes and just carried on meditating. But it was that fear of death actually put him on just over into deep meditation. He really let go. And even in, I was told, in Laos there was a very good meditation monastery before the communists took over. And the monk there had a very high reputation of being a very great jhana teacher. And how he used to really get his monks into jhana, he used to take them walking in the jungle all day until they were sweaty and tired, and then he'd always aim to get to a particular place in the jungle where the villagers, under his instructions, had built these platforms high up in the trees. And the platforms were just about the same size as the cushion I'm sitting on now. Just enough to sit on, not enough to lie on. With no railings on the outside. And it was high up in the branches of the tree with a ladder going up, and he would tell the monk to climb up there. And the monk climbed up there, said, sit down. And then the head monk, the abbot, would take the ladder away and say, I'll be back in the morning. And they had to sit high up in the tree on this little platform. Not enough to lay down on, and certainly if they started to nod, they would fall off. They got many great monks that way. And no casualties. So, tomorrow I'm going to ask Bianca Ron, who's a very good carpenter, to build a couple of platforms in those high trees over there. Get monks to the guy. Because what is happening here is like the fear of death. It's death meditation. And it really, one, it starts to get you alert and awake, and it also makes you very peaceful, and at the same time very wise. It's samatha and vipassana working together. In some monasteries, we did this once at our monastery in Thailand, because the villagers actually built a coffin for us. and it wasn't actually for us, it was just a coffin which was hired, a very poor, poorly made coffin, so when any villager died, they wouldn't have to spend all this money having a huge coffin on display. They'd make a plywood coffin and put it inside this very nice coffin, so it could be reusable, recyclable coffin. But of course, monks being monks, we decided that it's a great opportunity to sleep in this from time to time. So we practice being dead. So sometimes we'd queue up and we'd, at night time, instead of going back to our huts, we'd lay down in the coffin and imagine we were dead. And it's wonderful meditation, because we were just trying it out for size, because one day we'd use it. And what it did again, just the whole idea of like sleeping in a coffin at night, it just brought all this idea and thoughts about death, I'm going to die, that's for sure. And it made you, one, very wise and very peaceful. The wisdom which comes from death meditation is to not cling to anything, not attached to anything, to realize all your possessions are not yours, they're on loan to you. If the thing is really yours, you can take them with you. If they're on loan, you have to give them back. All your possessions, your house, your property, your wealth, that's only on loan to you. You have to give it back to someone else, to your kids, to the government or someone. And even this body is not yours, it's only on loan to you. There comes a time when you have to give this body up. It's not yours. Once you start to really understand that, it gets rid of the attachment to property, to material things. It gets rid of the attachment to your body. And if you can get rid of the attachment to the body, a lot of the aches and pains and difficulties of the body aren't so worrying to you. It's just to be used for the time being. It's not important. It's on loan. If you had a loan car and it had a crash, would you be so upset as if it was your own car which had a crash? So this is a loan car you're travelling in. It's not sort of a your own vehicle. So the death meditation, if it's done, is reflecting on death, such as by doing the mantra, I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Will make you very peaceful and calm once you get rid of the fear. And also, it will give you great insight and wisdom. You'll have a sense of freeing yourself from burdens, letting go of things. What it also does, when I will die, that's for sure, it makes it much easier to stay in the present moment. Because you don't know if you're going to have a next moment. So why worry and think about it? Instead, we just keep in the present moment, because we don't know how many more present moments we're going to have left. It makes it much easier to be present. So the death meditation is very useful, to be able to bring the mind to the present moment, have a little bit of fun on the meditation path, getting yourself very interested, stimulated, because it's a stimulating meditation. Imagining yourself dying, imagine all your friends coming, or actually finding out who your friends really are and who doesn't come because they're too busy. And then just thinking about all the things you have to let go of. When you do this, again, it does create the peacefulness and calmness of the mind. And that's what this meditation is all about, to create that calmness, to create that peace, to create that wisdom. And when you go and sit next time doing the breath meditation, the breath is very easy, because you've let go of many of the things which make the breath meditation difficult. Attachment to the body, attachment to things, worry about this, worry about that, a lack of calm in the mind. You do breath meditation first and then do breath meditation, it's just so easy. The mind is peaceful, the mind is inspired. You realize this is what you should have been doing all along. Let's see death meditation. There's also other meditations I wanted to talk about, such as like the loving kindness meditation. Sometimes the death meditation, if you're one of these people who are very depressed and morose and you haven't got much energy anyway and you're in a bad mood, that might get you even into a more bad mood. So sometimes it's nice to do other meditation, like more fun meditation, like loving kindness meditation. And loving kindness meditation is where you just dwell upon that feeling of love for all beings. May all beings be happy and well, including you. So that loving kindness meditation is the antidote, the best way of overcoming ill will. And I've already mentioned that as one of the great hindrances to meditation. And I know it's a great breakthrough for myself when, instead of teachers telling me ill will meant hating the person next to me, because I didn't really hate the person next to me, and I thought I didn't have any ill will, I thought I'd overcome that hindrance. But no, it was ill will towards myself, ill will towards the meditation object. I didn't care about the people sitting next to me, but I did care about me and I did care about my meditation, and I had ill will towards it. And that's why I realized, yeah, I did need to do loving kindness meditation. Especially loving kindness meditation to myself. To cheer myself up, to say, yeah, you deserve happiness. I allow you to be happy. I give you the gift of happiness. One way of doing loving kindness meditation, which is a useful way, is to do that imagination of the box. Instead of this time, just put, instead of peace, put love in it. You know that cardboard box, and you wrap it up and you put a ribbon around it, a little message to me with love from me, and give yourself that love, that acceptance. Give yourself the gift of happiness. And sometimes it's amazing just how powerful that can be. Sometimes the reason why people don't get into deep meditation, why the meditation doesn't really bite, because they don't allow themselves to be at peace. They don't allow themselves to have happiness. Especially for Westerners who are very often into guilt. They've done something wrong, they don't think they deserve to be happy. And some of that remorse can be from years and years back, very deeply embedded in the psyche, which stops you being happy in any aspect of your life. And so that loving kindness meditation, where you keep on focusing on the thought, on the movement of mind which gives you happiness, which gives you joy, which gives you peace. May I be happy and well, may I be at peace. You find that that will release a lot of hindrances. It will unlock a lot of doors. And you'll find that you will be able to be at peace. That happiness will come. Happiness has been trying to come for many years, but you haven't let it in. So you say, may I forgive all of my faults. Even on this meditation retreat, sometimes people have had rotten meditations and they're blaming themselves for it. I'm hopeless, I'm terrible, I should know better than this. That's like getting to guilt again, blaming yourself. That's why the love, loving kindness, is so close to letting go. Because it includes forgiveness. That's why if I've had a rotten meditation in the morning, even just before the morning, as soon as I remember, mindfulness comes back, I forgive all the rotten meditation I've had so far. I don't even mingle with it. And I say, let that all go. Forgive. Absolute forgiveness. And that frees me to get into a good meditation the very next moment. You can flip straight away from meditation which is all over the place to meditation which is blissful and peaceful. With hardly any preparation, without any sort of work in between. Because you don't carry around the past. That's what forgiveness is. That's what loving kindness is. In the way I teach loving kindness, one of the most powerful words is, the door of my heart always open to me, no matter what I've done. It's a beautiful saying, because sometimes what I've done is what I've done so far in this retreat, let alone what I've done so far in my life. You say, the door of my heart is open to that. You completely let go of the past and face the present moment with a sense of kindness, with a sense of appreciation, with a sense of value. Because that's what loving kindness means. One of the nicest things, as well as doing loving kindness for yourself, actually to say that to yourself, look, me, the door of my heart's open, no matter what I've ever done. I'm going to be friends with me during this retreat. I'm not going to go around beating myself over the back because I don't live up to my expectations. I'm just going to be happy and friendly no matter what I do. Just like a mother loves her child. When the mother loves her child, no matter what the child does, the mother's so proud of that child. even if the child is a bank robber. But my child's such a good bank robber. Much better than much better than all the other bank robbers. Now let's go to a bit of an extreme, I agree. But mothers are like that sometimes. They're just so proud of their children. Because that's what happened to me the first time I went back to see my mother after being a monk for 7 years. I went back to London. And I went back there especially to spend time with her, because I had seen her for 7 years. I know what mothers think about their children, but I wasn't quite sure how she felt about me being a monk. And the first Saturday I was there, Saturday morning, was when she went to the shops. And in London, they didn't have shopping malls, they had high streets, those who've been in London. So all the shops were like lying the main street of the towns and the suburbs. So I went with my mother, sort of shopping on a Saturday morning, just to spend time with her. The first thing which really shocked me, I expected her to sort of like walk a few, couple of places behind me, or you know, three or four steps ahead. So you know, she wasn't associated with this funny person in the brown robes. But I was very surprised that she walked right alongside me. She wasn't embarrassed about me at all. And when they actually got to the shops, because they're very, you know, England is a very small city, in order to protect the people walking on the pavement from the busy road, they had like sort of railings along the roadside. And that would also be the place where the people, before they went into the shops, they would leave the prams and tie up the dogs. And that's where I thought my mother would leave me as well. with the babies and the dogs while she went into the shops, because I thought she'd be embarrassed. But not at all. She dragged me into the shop. She wasn't at all embarrassed that she was with a funny-looking man. This was, 18 years ago. And she introduced me. This is my son, the monk. And I was really sort of taken aback and surprised by that. I really thought that she'd be sort of trying to hide her face from me, like putting on dark glasses and a scarf so she wouldn't be recognised or something. But no, she was very proud. That really told me about a mother's love for her son. No matter what your mother does, so not what your son does, so the mother's always proud and accepting. That's the sort of love to have for yourself. No matter what you've done, no need to wear dark glasses and try and hide it from yourself and have that ill will towards yourself. Just have that full acceptance and friendliness and love towards yourself. I am all right. I will do. And with that love, you can see, just as my mother kept right beside me because she had that love, in the same way, if you have the love towards yourself, you don't run away from yourself. You don't run away from the moment. You're not trying to escape from anything. A lot of the wandering mind is escaping. What are you trying to escape from? What you're trying to escape is some idea of yourself which you think is inadequate or hopeless. So with that love, it's like a mother's love towards her child. You don't judge your child. It's just my son, my daughter, that's it. I love them. Don't care what anyone else says, I want to be with them. In this meditation, don't care what anyone else says about you. I want to be with you. This is what you say to yourself. And with that sense of love, you find it easier to be in the moment, to be with yourself, and not frantically try to escape somewhere else, into dreams, into fantasies, or into sleep. And then you can actually spread that same sort of loving kindness towards your meditation object. And it overcomes the ill will towards the meditation object. It's very easy, especially at this time in the retreat, to have ill will towards the breath. Another 4 days of watching this breath. I've had enough. And just that very attitude of, I've had enough, I don't want to watch the breath. Oh, here we go again, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in. What did I get myself in? Never again, okay? Never again, 9-day retreat, breathing in, breathing out. Now remember this time, you said that last time, and you come here again. Never again. This time, instead of doing that, sort of like breathing with love, with kindness. Just like a mother cooing over her baby. You know, sometimes these little brats which mothers have, and the mother said, it's just a lovely baby, such a beautiful baby. And to me, it's a brat. But mothers can't see that. Now, if you can do the same perception with your breath, even though that sometimes now you think your breath is a brat, it never does the right thing. It always runs away and is very naughty. and create so much trouble for you watching after this breath. Look after it like a mother looks after it. This is beautiful breath. Be kind to it. Coo over it. Stroke it. Cuddle your breath. Cuddle it. Bring it close to your heart. That's beautiful breath. You're okay. You're the only breath I've got, so I'm going to look after you. If you have like loving kindness towards your breath, whatever you love, you enjoy. And whatever you love, you can only see the beauty in. Whatever you hate, you can only see the ugliness in. And this is why if you develop loving kindness towards the breath, straight away the beautiful breath comes up very quickly. Because you're loving the breath, it becomes beautiful. With that, with that loving kindness on the breath, just imagine the breath like a being, like a little cat or like a puppy or like a baby. This is something you're nurturing. Nurturing and guarding, guarding and nurturing. Beautiful breath. And I can spend as long as it takes with you until you develop into this beautiful nimitta. With that loving kindness, you have the softness of the mind which is necessary for deep meditation. You have the ability to hold the object without any force. You don't have to force a mother to be with a baby. It's just a natural attraction. And that way it becomes so easy to watch the breath. This is like doing loving kindness together with the breath. Loving kindness towards yourself, loving kindness towards all other beings. Please, from time to time in this meditation retreat, practice some loving kindness meditation, because it just warms the heart, it gives beautiful energy, it gives softness, and it just gives that little bit of variation which just the mind might need just to keep it bright and cheery. You can also just do bare loving kindness meditation if you wish, just loving kindness to all beings. Develop it first as a thought, keep that thought going until you find the meaning of that thought. This is where I come into the mantra meditation, because this is where the breath, the loving kindness is like a mantra. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be happy and well. Sometimes if you make loving kindness too complex and you've got this whole list of things you've got to wish for all beings, sometimes you can't remember them all. Keep it simple. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be happy and well. Or whatever other words really inspire you, like I would do, the door of my heart is open to all beings, no matter what they've ever done. But when you do a mantra, instead of just repeating the words to yourself over and over and over and over again, what I like to do with mantra meditation is after the words are finished, then I listen to their echo. And the door of my heart is always open to me, no matter what I've ever done. And I listen to what that does to my mind. And you can, straight away you can feel this great opening, this great sense of peace and acceptance, this great ease in the mind. And I stay with that until it disappears. And I say again, the door of my heart is always open to me, no matter what I've ever done. I listen again. Or if you use that, may all beings be happy and well, be at peace. Listen to what that does. Because all these words, all these mantras, they're like signposts. They point the mind to something. And if you just stick on the signpost and don't look to where it's pointing, you'll miss the meaning, you'll miss the power. The same with, I will die, that's for sure. What does that do? Where does that point the mind? Once you can actually see where these things are pointing, may all beings be happy and well. Once that you can see what that's pointing to, you don't need to look at the signpost anymore. You do not need to repeat the words. You have loving kindness right in front of your mind. And all you need to do is to dwell on where that signpost, may all beings be happy and well, is pointing. You dwell upon the the object of loving kindness. Not the words, but the object. That can be accompanied by a feeling in the body. Again, I like to just to disembody all of these concepts. I have it as a as part of the territory of the mind, a mind object. May all beings be happy and well. And there, right in front of my mind, is loving kindness. And I just hold that gently, without force, without trying to do anything, in my mind, in the same way you hold the breath, without doing anything, without trying, simply because the object that is loving kindness is very attractive and very beautiful. Once it's risen up, if you can just leave it alone and just watch effortlessly, it stays there all by itself. Such a lovely thing to abide with. One of the advantages of loving kindness meditation, pure loving kindness meditation over the breath, is that the nature of loving kindness is beautiful. With the breath, you have to perceive the beauty in the breath. It takes a bit of training. With meditation on metta, it's natural, you can't miss the attractive quality of that mental object. Once that attractive quality of loving kindness is strong enough, so it just stays there just by itself and you just can't get out of it because it's just so beautiful, so peaceful. From that, nimittas will come up and jhanas will arise in exactly the same way as with breath meditation. That's why sometimes people do use loving kindness as a bona fide path into jhanas. And it's not just samatha, because you learn a lot about the hindrances to letting go, the ill will which you have towards yourself, others, meditation object, which is one of the biggest fetters which people carry around with them. It stops them being free, it stops them experiencing happiness. That's why in a simile of the hindrances, the Buddha called ill will a sickness. It's a disease which keeps the mind from being happy, from being healthy. And that's the antidote, loving kindness. But of course, you've got to want to take the medicine first of all. Sometimes people don't like to take their medicines. So take the medicine, and after a while it tastes very nice. That's loving kindness meditation. I also came on to the point of mantras. And a mantra is another lovely thing you can use in the meditation. A mantra is a word which you say to yourself again and again, over and over, listening to the meaning if you can. That's why, as many of you have heard me talk before about meditation, one of the best mantras, especially if you're restless and think a lot, is use it with the breath as you breathe in, shut. As you breathe out, up. Shut, up. Shut, up. It's very effective. Try it out. If you think, 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 and the breath goes in, say shut. Breath goes out, up. Be quiet. Stop talking to yourself inside all day. And what it actually does, it's a bit of good fun. And meditation is fun. Enjoy yourself, just make it sort of jovial, because that gives a sense of lightheartedness which gives rise to freedom. So this is giving the mantra meditation some sort of meaning. It's not just some sort of Sanskrit word which you say to yourself, but it's something which is meaningful. If it's not shut up, you can make your own mantras. You can make a mantra like love if you want to develop love meditation. Just one word, just love. You breathe in, just say love. Just keep on going. Because all it's doing is the same process as brainwashing. And if you keep on a subject again and again and again and again, despite what you want to do or what you think, it goes in there and it works. That's why I give all these talks during the retreat, because I'm brainwashing you. It's actually conditioning, that's all it is. So by doing that, the word again and again and again, it brainwashes you. That's why in an army at war they say, anger, fight, kill, 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 kill. And it brainwashes you to be violent. So if you actually brainwash yourself, love, love, love. Or another lovely one is like peace. Just those words, just say peace to yourself. Peace. And what does that do? You say that word to yourself, you listen afterwards, peace. You find yourself just all going loose and all quiet, peace. Peace. Now you can see the power of these mantras. So if you're doing a breath meditation or you're doing whatever meditation, or even when you're back out there in the world and you want to get quiet very quickly, you're sitting at the office chair, at the desk, sorry, on your chair in the office, close your eyes and just say peace. When the echo fades, say it again, peace. By the echo I meant the feeling inside the body and mind. And keep on saying it to yourself until that peace, where it's pointing to, is established in the mind. You can do that with your walking meditation, peace. If you walk, peace, peace. But keep it going for long enough. Don't be impatient and just give up after 1 or 2 minutes. Keep it going and you'll find it has a great deal of power. So those are a couple of the mantras which I use. Peace, love. Shall you shut up now and again? Whatever mantra actually means something to you, and you can make up your own. But also, somebody did ask at the last night about the mantra Buddha, and this was actually the meditation which the forest teachers used to use, started by Ajahn Mun, and Ajahn Chah used to use it, Ajahn Mahabhur, and this was the great meditation technique which they used, using a mantra together with the breath. To do the Buddha meditation, as you breathe in, you think to yourself, Bud. As you breathe out, Po. Bud. Po. Bud. Po. Now remember, these were village Thai monks. Monks who have been brought up in a village. They've been brought up with Buddhism. They've been immersed in Buddhism, you know, since they were born. So for these people, the word Buddha was an incredibly powerful word. It brought up all of the religious emotions of what the Buddha meant, who the Buddha was, and the figure, the compassion, all the stories they'd heard when they were at school, when they were very young. It was incredibly powerful to them. And that's why that if you are a traditional Buddhist, or if you are a Buddhist who really has a sense of love and respect for something called the Buddha, then that does become a very strong means to deep meditation. Simply because when you're saying Buddha, you're not just saying as a word, you're saying with love, with respect, with deep devotion. And that way, when you're saying Buddha, the meaning of the word calms the breath and inspires the mind to stay with the breath, because you're aligning the breath with the great Buddha. Buddha equals breath, breath equals Buddha. And because of that, the breath becomes just so delightful. So it's not just a word, it's what the word means which is most important. And that's why, for those traditional Northeast Thai monks, the meditation on Buddha was incredibly successful. However, with such mantras, when they were doing it together with the breath, they always come to the time when they'd have to drop the Buddha and just stay with the breath. So there'd be no more saying Buddha, 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 because that would be the mind which was just too noisy. It would be just the breath and the silent Buddha, just being with the breath. The Buddha was the vehicle used to get into that deeper stage. Remember, each of these stages are just different ways of getting to the same place. In the sutras, there was a story just before the Buddha died of the king of Magadha, at that time Ajatasattu. I heard that the Buddha was staying in the bamboo grove, in the hall in the bamboo grove. And so the king Ajatasattu got in his chariot to visit the Buddha and went in his chariot as far as chariots could go, and then stepped down and went on foot in his sandals as far as he could go by foot in sandals. Then at the entrance to the hall he took off his sandals and then went barefoot into the presence of the Buddha. You can see that he needed a chariot first of all, and then shoes, and then bare feet. In the same way, you can use Buddha as your chariot. Then you have to let go of Buddha and just go in your shoes, just in the breath. There comes a time, Do you really want to go into the hall where the Buddha's sitting, into jhanas? It doesn't mean you see the Buddha in jhanas, but you understand what the Buddha is. If you want to go into the hall where the Buddha's sitting, you have to take off the breath. Just go into the realm of the mind. It's a very beautiful simile, but you've got to go in chariot as far as a chariot can go. If you try and walk in barefoot right from the palace, you're asking for trouble. You step on thorns, you step on snakes. So go in the chariot as far as the chariot goes. In this case, do the buddho as far as you need to have that mantra. And then let go of the mantra. Have just the bare breath. And then let go of the breath. So you can go into the nimittas, into jhanas, into the hall where the Buddha's sitting. So that's how one does some of the mantra meditations. One of the other mantra meditations which I do, which I haven't mentioned yet, which again is a very powerful one, is just to let go. As you're breathing, don't say buddho, say let go. Let go. Let go. And that's what you can do with your walking meditation as well. You walk left foot, let, right foot, go. Let go. Let go. Because what that does again, that's informing your mind, telling your mind, instructing your mind, and no matter how stubborn you think you are, if you keep saying it long enough, eventually your mind will let go. And that's doing letting be meditation, letting go meditation. I've mentioned this to a lot of people that sometimes the thing we should focus on most of all in the meditation is just doing nothing, letting go. And again, it's so hard for people to know how to let go. They know they should let go, they want to let go, but they don't know how to let go. And so sometimes I even used to do, a long time ago, just say a letting be meditation. I used to use the mantra, no desire. So I was breathing in, no, breathing out, desire. No desire. Because that was like the third noble truth, stopping craving, no desire. And that would be my mantra. And that would get rid of a lot of coarse movements of the mind. And after I'd settled down by doing no desire, then I'd turn on to the breath meditation. What I used to teach other people is that using an imagery of modern day life. Just imagine you're in a car. What letting be meditation is you have the confidence and trust to take your hand off the steering wheel and feet off the pedals and let go. And if you do that imaginary exercise, you're meditating on the breath or whatever, you're not getting anywhere. Imagine you're at the controls of a car. Make that a very clear imaginary image in your mind. And then imagine yourself, feel your hands on the wheel of the steering wheel of the car. And imagine you taking your hands off. Why don't you want to take your hands off? Because you're afraid you might have a crash. In meditation, that's why you can't let go, because you're afraid that something will go wrong. So have that confidence and trust. So I was saying, as the first of the five spiritual powers, take your hands off the steering wheel. See what happens. You can always put them back on again anytime you like, but take them off for a while first of all and see what it's like. Let go. Take your feet off the pedals for a few moments. Imagine, you know, pushing these pedals down with your feet. Imagine just lifting the feet up and putting them somewhere else. Imagine that, and psychologically you will be letting go of much more than driving a car. You will actually just be freewheeling. Just the mind will let go and you'll taste the degree of peacefulness. So this is one of the other meditations which we can do, letting be meditation. I was going to do quite a few more of other meditations, but those are the main meditations which I do, and which I can invite you to try alongside the breath, so that you have this whole bag of tools which you could use from time to time to help you gain this peace and this wisdom, this calm and insight of the meditation. So the ones which I have talked about today was the death meditation. I invite you this morning to try that on a walking path. I will die, that's for sure. It's great fun. And secondly, I mentioned the loving kindness meditation. Try loving kindness on yourself and on your meditation object. Take it up as a baby. Or third, I mentioned the mantra meditations. So I've got a lot of different techniques today for you to play with. So play around with them, find out which ones work for you, and have fun. Any questions? Yes? Yeah? Oh yeah.
One of my friends learned from him, and then she concentrated on the skeleton. But after 3 months later, she keep on losing weight.
She keep on losing weight. She became a skeleton. That's it. Correct meditation for fat women. As a fat monks as well. Now it can be a good one, but the thing is, with being able to do a skeleton, you need the ability to focus your attention for long periods of time on something which is inherently even. It's got no sort of quality to it, a skeleton. For many people, it just gives rise to fear because they associate skeletons with ghosts. And so sometimes it's very hard to do that. What it's a monk's meditation, a nun's meditation, because very often what one does, one uses that as a combination of death meditation and body meditation. So it takes a while. You usually get your skill and your power by doing breath meditation first of all. You train yourself in the ability to hold an object by investing it with a sense of happiness and joy, by seeing the pleasant in it, seeing the beautiful in it. And as a monk, you can do that with a skeleton or with a part of the skeleton, like a skull, and just to focus on it until you can hold it in your mind. And you can only hold things in your mind if you can see the interest in it, the fascination, the beauty in it. And that's a very hard thing to do, so very few monks actually do that. But once you can do it, it's very positive, because you can hold it in your mind, and what happens, it's a strange thing, it's the nature of the mind to do this. If you're holding like a skull in your mind, the skull starts to get this beautiful white colour, and you don't see the features anymore, it turns into a beautiful nimitta. And it can take you into a jhana. And that's how some monks, they use like those bodily parts like a skeleton, because its whiteness just starts to glow and the whole thing opens up like a star. They can get into jhanas that way. The rest of the time, that when you say a monk is seeing a very beautiful girl, all he sees is a skeleton. And that was the story of there's one monk in the time of the Buddha did that with teeth. Instead of seeing the whole skeleton, just focus on teeth, and he could actually get into deep meditation just on teeth. And when he saw someone, he just saw a set of teeth going past. And this is actually what happened, because this monk was walking along the road, and there was a woman who just was running away from her husband. And because she had an argument, and she was running off from her husband. And then the husband came looking for his wife afterwards and saw the monk and said, "You didn't see my wife going past?" He said, "No, but I saw a pair of teeth going past." And that might start to find, actually, that's what happens when you do these sorts of meditations. What is a person anyway? I mean, sometimes you say when you see a person walking past, you just see you saw their face going past. Because that's what you look at. You don't see their feet going past, just their face. And this monk, his perception was just teeth, and so he just saw a pair of teeth going past. So that's what you can do, just see a skull going past. And that's all it is. So it takes away sort of all of the perception of like lust when you can do these sorts of things. Because I know they say that beauty is skin deep, and it's true. The most beautiful woman or the most strong, handsome man, look at their skulls. Or you don't like to kiss them. You don't like to sort of hug a skeleton. Unless you're weird. So, and that's actually, just where you are. Remember what I was saying the other day about the nails, hair, teeth, the hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin, that's all dead. And that's just covering the skeleton. So, really, when you sort of cuddle someone, you're just cuddling the skeleton. which is covered with dead stuff. So it takes away all the lust and all that sort of stuff, and it makes you so much more peaceful. Then you see a person as a person, not as a sort of sex object, not as a gender object, but just as a person, as a human being. So it takes away a lot of the other stuff which creates attachments and cravings and which make distinctions between people. So you're much more even-minded, much more fair, much more love which goes to all beings rather than just, you know, ones which you like. So you can do that skeleton meditation, but it's very hard. And you find if you can't do the breath meditation, there's no way you do skeleton meditation. It's a very good question. The highest jhana you can get into in metta meditation. It was only the commentaries which actually said that you can only get into first jhana from metta, but I really disagree with that. Because when you get into, you do the metta meditation as I know of doing it, you can get a nimitta coming up. And once you get a nimitta coming up, it's like the whether you use metta to get a nimitta, or you use breath to get a nimitta, or something else to get a nimitta. Once you get a nimitta, if you know what to do with a nimitta, the rest becomes a natural letting go of the mind, and you can go to whatever jhana you want to. Once you get that nimitta coming up, it's just letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go. And just the more you let go, and there's no law why, because you get the nimitta through metta, that you can't let go of as much as when you get the nimitta through breath meditation. Nimitta. Yeah. That's right, you have to go through the nimitta to get into these jhanas. So if you, just because you've got this beautiful feeling of loving kindness for long periods of time, it doesn't mean that it's a jhana. One of the, again, this is one of the talks coming up later on, what actually are these jhanas, and how do you get, from the meditation on the breath or loving kindness into these jhanas. And I want to give that talk later on, even though it might not be relevant to people in their present meditation practice. It's important to say so that when it does happen, you know what to do. But really, it's just that nimitta is the doorway. And once you go through that doorway, all the rooms in that house are accessible to you. Even though sort of that contradicts what it says in the Visuddhimagga. But I don't mind contradicting that from time to time. Any other questions? Okay, let's get out. Why do you think that Western people are more afflicted with guilt than Easterners? I get into trouble because of this, especially here. I think it's Christianity and Judaism and those religions. For some reason, I mean, what's the first thing which happened in Christianity? Original sin, right at the very beginning. And that's sometimes being drummed into us. Sometimes you do something wrong as a kid and you say sorry, that's not good enough, you've got to really feel sorry. And if you really feel sorry and have a lot of remorse, then you get forgiven. And I mentioned this actually recently. I went to give a couple of talks, semi-lectures, to the local university's law school on religious attitudes in Australian law. And I was saying, look, if it was like a real good Buddhist who understood things and they did commit an offence, I wouldn't expect them to have so much remorse. That wouldn't be in their character. However, if you're convicted of an offence, the amount of remorse you have, the amount of guilt you show, is a very important factor in determining your sentence. So if it was a Buddhist and said, oh, I made a mistake, I've forgiven myself and forgiven others, you get, twice the length of years in jail. See, if you're a Christian, say, oh, I feel terribly sorry, oh, I feel rotten, I feel horrible, oh, I wish I never did this. And you get into that sort of psychosis, that craziness, then the judge will say, okay, I'll give you a light sentence. And it's true, because it's a culture that we're expected to feel guilty. And if you do something you don't feel guilty, they think you're really strange and you're terribly bad. you should feel guilty you've done something like that. No. Just a few days ago, one of the Anangarikas crashed our car, the monastery van. When he came afterwards, sort of, you know, I was half, I must admit, I was very happy he wasn't sort of upset about it, wasn't guilty about it. But then again, I thought, well, he should be a little bit guilty. So I caught myself, I was conditioned as well. Good car, no, yeah. No, I didn't that time. So anyhow, that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of us have that guilt, because of our condition. From the time we're very small, it's been drummed into us, you should feel guilty. And if you do something, what I was always taught, if you do something right, never praise yourself, because you just get proud, you just get egotistical, you just get arrogant. So all my young life, if I did something wrong, I got told off straight away, and I was made to feel guilty, go to my room, punished. And I did something really good, okay, that's okay. And that was it. And there's always like punishment for faults, and anything good was taken for granted. So that was actually psychologically very harmful. So forgive the faults, don't forgive the goodness. Have a party. If any of you get into jhanas, even if it's in the afternoon, you can go into that kitchen and make yourself a sandwich you can eat in the afternoon. No, you won't get in trouble. You got my permission, but only if you get into a jhana. Give yourself a reward. Give yourself... Praise yourself. Because that way you get into... No, whatever it is, whatever sort of, that is a celebration. Celebrate it for any goodness which you do. Don't let it just pass by. Praise yourself, celebrate, have a good time. You'll find that you'll do that again. So that's the incentive to get jhanas. You can have something to eat this evening. Okay. Thanks for all those questions.